Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
My name is Kai. I am an investor at Primary Venture Partners in New York City. It's a pre-seed, seed stage fund focused generally on the New York City market. Excited to be here.
Kai, thanks so much for making time to join us on the Ivy Podcast. Before we dive in and spend a great deal of time talking about your current role, current organization, give us a thumbnail version of your career prior to that.
Yeah, I mean, I'll start from the beginning. I grew up in the Bronx in New York, so it's kind of coming full circle, joining Primary. I am the son of two small business owners, so entrepreneurship is kind of running deep in the family. Grew up playing soccer and a bunch of video games and started my first business at 16 with my friends. It was a direct-to-consumer clothing company. We had some sort of pop-up shops and brick and mortar here and there, but mainly sort of e-commerce before e-commerce was really a thing. After that, went to Williams College, where there was very little, if any, entrepreneurial activity, but I'd caught the bug on, you know, wanting to build businesses and kind of spent most of my time in school building out the entrepreneurship program there. And when I wasn't doing that, actually on the complete opposite side of things, I was doing a bunch of public health research and with the thought that I might go to medical school after college, but ultimately realized that I just couldn't commit to that and that I was way too deep into all things entrepreneurship. And I spent a bunch of time doing public health research, economic development, before taking my first full-time job at Microsoft, working on the corporate external and legal affairs team as a financial analyst, mostly dealing with climate finance. And then earlier this year, joined Primary. So that's kind of the quick background on career.
That's pretty cool. Very exciting, diverse backgrounds. Tell us a little bit more about the journey getting into venture capital. Was that something that you've planned and aspired to get into? How did the whole thought process, essentially figuring out that venture capital is something that's of an interesting career path? Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I would say I was more of an operator or like a person who's in more of a founder mentality. Like I was always trying to build something. And whether that was, as I mentioned before, on campus, like student clubs or getting resources for students or pitching in the business competition, I was always sort of in the ecosystem there. And as a result, a friend of mine actually introduced me to venture. He came up to me one day on campus and said, "Hey, you're doing a lot of stuff around organizing these pitch competitions. Maybe you ever consider working in VC." And I was like, "What? What's VC? It sounds like a disease, like, or a drug. Like, I don't really want to do it." And ended up actually just preparing for that interview. He made an introduction to a firm out in San Francisco. And I actually ended up getting that internship. And what I find really funny about that is that once I did the internship towards the end, I was kind of going through the Google Drive it was a growth equity firm in San Francisco. I was going through the Google Drive and I found the interview notes for my candidacy at the growth equity firm. And it said, "Really thoughtful, really nice guy, clearly has no idea what venture capital is." And didn't actually end up being that much of a sticking point, but that summer kind of just completely shifted my perspective on VC and on getting into VC and what VC would look like in terms of possible career outlook. Largely because my biggest takeaway was that even though I didn't know anything, neither did anyone else who was in the Bay or working at any of these large firms. And don't get me wrong, the Bay was filled with incredibly smart people and every day was an opportunity to meet someone new and do something interesting and dig deeper into new technologies. But it was kind of one of these light bulb moments where I realized, oh, like anyone can do this, and kind of got really interested. So more tactically, I'd say breaking into venture was really a function of positioning myself as a peer to other investors long before I even knew what that would look like. And so for almost 4 years, I guess I would say I pretended to be an investor. So, you know, I went to, you know, industry events. I went to conferences. I took notes on meetings. I sent them to other investors. I got into contact with partners. I tried to help founders and basically did anything and everything that an investor would do, such that when it came time to actually try to transition into the industry, it would be sort of a soft transitioning or a soft landing, and that people would see me more as a peer than someone who was looking for a job. So that's kind of how I got into venture. I was working at Microsoft most recently, and realized that working at a large company just really wasn't well suited for me, just in light of all the things that I had done before, and kind of decided to take the leap, and had a ton of help from programs like Black VC, Colorwave, and a number of other sort of access to venture capital programs, but ultimately made the leap earlier this year.
Well, that's very exciting. Definitely an unusual path. And, you know, it seems like, you know, overall, it's there's no clear cut paths to VC of everyone that I talk to, and myself included. It's, you know, coming from a operator entrepreneurial background myself, I've, you know, successfully failed multiple companies of my own. And it's also an opportunity to connect with other startup founders, which is always very exciting, whether you talk from an investor standpoint, angel investing, or whatever the case may be. So that's always exciting. So fast forward, you know, how long you've been with the current company?
I've been at Primary now almost 9 months. Under a year. Yeah.
What are some of the, some things are pretty obvious in terms of the investment side and, you know, deal sourcing and then working with the founders, trying to, you know, be the value add investor from that perspective. What are some of the things that you did not expect that wasn't really, you know, so something of that, you know, as you got into the industry that you've discovered that was okay, that you know, that's something definitely, you know, I did not expect about venture capital, something that not necessarily a bad thing, not necessarily a dark side, so to say, but something that was totally unexpected that you completely overlooked or underrated.
Yeah, I mean, two things come immediately to mind. The first is that, you know, by virtue of where I grew up and who I grew up in the company of, most of my life has been oriented towards finding reasons to say yes, or finding opportunities or creating opportunities for myself. And the biggest shift I think that I had to make when becoming an investor was finding reasons to say no. So I would take, you know, every meeting, and I'd always find a way to say, okay, yeah, this person can get it done if they can just figure this, and this out. And I, you know, in many ways still kind of have that mentality where I kind of want to bet on everyone, because if you're crazy enough to go out and start a business, and I think you have something there. But, you know, great investors kind of poke every hole and like turn over every stone. And so finding reasons to say no has probably been the biggest mindset shift that I didn't quite expect. And maybe that's just kind of the early phase of being an investor, and I'll sort of dip into the tro and come back out eventually. But right now I'm sort of transitioning into that mindset. The second thing that comes to mind that was a surprise is how much people invest on momentum. And there are a ton of jokes around like how venture investors operate and what gets people excited, but there is a lot of looking around to see what everyone else is doing and kind of following on instead of building conviction and theses grounded in principles and values of your own. And one of the things that I've loved about transitioning into the industry is just getting a chance to show that there's another way to do it, and to build conviction around principles and, you know, concrete investment theses around different markets. So those are probably two things that I didn't expect.
Yeah, absolutely. That's definitely spot on, especially the second point that you're making in terms of momentum. You would definitely see that a lot. I come from a technical backgrounds. I've led technology teams in the corporate sector and then the startups. And whenever, you know, you're an executive over, you know, large corporation or a two-person startup, talent acquisition or, you know, surrounding yourself with the top performers is at the top of your mind 24/7, whether you're actively recruiting or not. So as you work with a great deal of portfolio companies with the founders that are building, scaling, you know, at immense speeds, I would imagine that's also one of the top priorities for them at all times. It doesn't matter if you actively interviewing somebody, probably just another meeting is also an opportunity to see if that the type of person that you would want to join your team. So tell us a little bit more about your thought process when it comes to talent acquisition, when you work with your founders. The reason I ask this is because, as we all know, it's such a highly competitive market these days, a candidate-driven market with so much opportunity out there, it becomes very challenging as war for talent out there is real. What are some of the strategies that really help you succeed in that space as you work with your founders?
Totally. Yeah, and I should say that, I mean, portfolio impact, as we call it at Primary, is sort of center to everything that we do. And one of the big pillars within that is talent. And within that talent pillar, I mean, there are a number of strategies that we kind of go after. The first, I would say, just on a personal note, is just kind of be human first. I think people oftentimes try to build relationships on a foundation of like, what sectors do we have in common or what kind of technological interests, but real relationships are built on the foundation of shared vulnerability. So trying to build friendships and trying to build real rapport with people, I think, goes a long way. Like, if you want to win a deal, you should probably work to win the hearts and minds of people you want to work with first and show them that what matters to them matters to you. Because at the end of the day, capital is capital, and you have compensation packages are going to come from a variety of companies. But sitting down and actually working with someone for 2, 3, 4, 5 years is a real big decision, and you want to be thoughtful about that. Beyond that, just talking about some of the programs that we have here at Primary, I mean, we think about this really comprehensively. So we leverage our own internal networks. By virtue of focusing exclusively on the New York market, we're able to tap into a wide variety of people who are either now flocking to New York in droves, or a lot of the people who are established in here for a long time. We tap into the networks of companies that have exited in the past. We've tapped into other startup networks. We've tapped into our portfolio. So we have a talent advisory program where, for instance, if you are a Series D company in our portfolio, let's say hypothetically, you've been recruiting, you have embedded recruiters, but not every candidate that makes it all the way to the final interview process is going to get a role at that particular startup. But that doesn't mean that they're not a promising candidate. And so those people can be surfaced for other opportunities within the portfolio. So creating greater leverage within our internal networks. We're spinning up entire communities around different sectors within talent. So we have a growth marketing community, a chief of staff community, and a number of other communities getting spun up every single day. And a number of other programs running concurrently. We have embedded recruiters on some of our teams where we're sending people who are trained in recruiting to go and find the right candidate for the portfolio founders. And just a number of other ways that we're thinking about trying to make sure that our founders are best positioned to execute at the highest levels. But talent is really core and sort of central to everything that we're doing here at Primary.
Yeah, definitely very, very interesting strategies in terms of leveraging the networks and, you know, the power of the community. I think that makes perfect sense. And to take that a little bit further, when it comes to interviewing, that's also a very challenging aspect of the entire process of the talent acquisition, where a lot of the interviews are based on that past personal experience rather than, you know, focusing on the strength that's missing on my team and more of a approach, what is the weakness that I can tolerate in that particular candidate? I guess that's also a form of an interview when you meet with the potential founders for investment opportunities. When you meet with them for the first time or the second time, what are some of your go-to favorite questions to ask? And I don't mean it from the perspective of, well, let me see if I can trip you up or some of the things that necessarily, you know, you may be hiding, but in a way that allows you really uncover their true personality, who they are, in a matter of such a short period of time, of whether that's a 30 or 60 minute meeting. What are some of the questions that you love to ask? And more importantly, what do you look for in the responses when you hear them?
Yeah, I mean, tactically, I think founders should know what kind of business they're trying to build. And I say that from the seat of an investor's focusing generally across different markets and different industries. I tend to focus more on business models. So that would be sort of the first line is, you know, if you tell me you're building a marketplace, then you should understand at the earliest stages that maybe the highest priority for you is actually building up liquidity. And everything that you're doing in the business, whether it's the go-to-market strategy or the problem that you're solving, should be oriented towards growing the business in that capacity. If you tell me you're building a vertical SaaS company, your priorities should shift and the activities and people that you're bringing around the table and your intention to grow and build the company should shift into that mindset as well. So that's the first thing is sort of the sniff test is, do you know what kind of business you're building? The second thing after that is really, why are you doing this? And maybe that should come first, but you know, before diving into who the founder is, getting a sense of what the business is the useful sort of screening. But if this isn't a personal or sort of deeply personal thing for you, then working on this for 7 to 10 years probably isn't going to be something that you're going to commit to. And we're sort of investors for the long haul. And so we want to invest in the best founders within New York. And part of that is just an understanding of why you're motivated to even build a company in the first place. The most interesting question I think that I ask is really around self-awareness. Like, you know, what's kind of keeping you up at night and why wouldn't this work? And you know, you kind of alluded to this, but there are tons of blind spots and there's more uncertainty in building a company than in most other things. And so the question is, you know, who are you going to bring around the table to kind of fill those gaps? And are you anticipating the range of possible futures and probabilities around what could happen with your business? I think founders who have that sense of self-awareness and an ability to recruit and retain people to fill those gaps tend to be the most successful. And if, you know, if I look at not all the investments that I've done, but certainly all the case studies and investments that I've looked at, the companies that have done really well, if you ask any investor, there wasn't much ambiguity on whether or not you wanted to support that founder. There might have been questions on the business itself and how that was going to pan out. But you usually had a great deal of confidence in the person behind the business, which ultimately at the end of the day makes the organization, because an organization is nothing but the people that are within that organization, how they respond to change and different things that are happening. So yeah, getting a sense of self-awareness, whether or not they understand the business and how they're going to respond when bad things do happen, because they will happen. And so understanding their kind of resiliency, I think it'd be really important.
Yeah, I like that. So from the self-awareness, especially perspective, I think what I've found is the founders that can very clearly articulate what they don't know, what are some of the areas that, you know, I'm not good at, or some areas that I definitely need to, you know, either bring somebody else in, not trying to do everything from that perspective. I think those are usually very, very positive early predictors from that standpoint. And just overall, from everything that you've been describing, it's kind of categorizing that, because as venture kind of the risk management aspect of the overall venture capital is just categorizing that into the, you know, the founder risk, the market risk, and then just the overall technical or the just the funding risk from that perspective, and just understanding some of the semantics of how you can de-risk certain elements from each of those categories. I think you alluded to some of the questions that you like to ask. What are some of the trends and you know, just overall trends that you're personally very excited about? We all, you know, you mentioned momentum, you've mentioned some of the kind of the things that, you know, I listened to a podcast. I can't remember the name, who said that VCs are like eagles because eagles don't flock. But then when we look at the momentum and we look at the different trends that actually occur, it actually quite the opposite, where all VCs actually do come together and invest as part of that kind of the hype. Aside from that, what are some of the trends that you've been researching, that you've been following yourself? What are you tinkering with nights and weekends that are not necessarily part of that little, you know, Twitter bubble, so to say?
Totally. Well, I'll start off with one that I think is pretty general that a lot of people are excited about. But, you know, increasingly, as I mentioned, sort of my background in public health and an original intention to kind of become a physician, the greater shift towards value-based care and the infusion of telemedicine and digital health is incredibly exciting, not least among the reasons is just improving patient outcomes, which I could talk for another 30 to 40 minutes about, as that was the center of a past life, let's say. But healthcare is incredibly exciting. We do a ton of healthcare here at Primary and are always looking to kind of push the needle there and provide better care to patients. Things that I'm personally excited about, I'd say there are really three things that are top of mind in no particular order. Cybersecurity is such an interesting opportunity because fundamentally defending something requires you, or I'll say it this way. Attacking something only requires finding one vulnerability, but defending something requires you to understand the range of possible attacks that could potentially happen and protect against all of them. And then also to remember to grow and change. And when you look at the market around cybersecurity or just around phishing or anything like that, the attackers are exponentially almost more sophisticated in their use of technology and tactics and behavioral tactics even in attacking these large enterprises. And large enterprises are moving ever more slowly and trying to decide between, you know, should we have a single pane of glass or should we have a bunch of point solutions that don't really operate with each other? So tons of opportunity in that space and just kind of like a really technically just challenging problem to solve, which is why it's sort of fascinating to me. Two would be like gaming. Anything and everything around gaming is just incredibly exciting right now. A lot of people are talking about crypto, the metaverse and all of that. But an interesting statistic is Axie Infinity, which is a company sort of in the gaming space, has a $1.5 billion run rate at this moment in time, which is just crazy to think about. And you start to think about the larger implications of something like that. I used to sit around the computer and play things like Gaia Online and RuneScape and, you know, MapleStory. And I spent hours in those games. And I can't even, if I tried to calculate the amount of money that I spent in in-app purchases so that my character could be better, you know, I probably could have invested all of that into the market and been a millionaire by now. So I have no doubt that this upcoming generation, which is even more infatuated with gaming, will continue to kind of invest in services like that. So there's a ton of opportunity to kind of invest in that space. And then most exciting for me is climate, 100%. Unfortunately, the excitement isn't excitement that the world is getting warmer, but it's the excitement and momentum around people actually waking up to that and starting to create solutions to ultimately, in my opinion, which is the most important thing, decarbonize the world, and just a ton of innovation around that. Biochar, you know, direct air carbon capture, but even more so now we're starting to see venture dip into it, software solutions, grid solutions, charging infrastructure. So I'm always looking to connect with people in the climate space. And one of the interesting things, and maybe the last note on trends, is climate tech and climate just in general, unlike every other industry, is so wildly collaborative because we're all facing this sort of existential crisis. And so you'll find that investors and founders, whether or not they're building or investing in the same space, are investing in each other, even if companies or technologies are competitive, because the ultimate aim at the end of the day is to get carbon out of the atmosphere, which makes for a really exciting investment environment and also makes for a really exciting just place to be and people to be around, because it's so generative and it's so like filled with reciprocity and love, I guess. So super exciting space and also just a great place to be as well.
That's awesome. I love the categories, the different sectors that you had, you know, basically compartmentalized, and some of these trends definitely can relate to a lot of them, from healthcare to gamification and gaming level, just in general. I experienced that on a daily basis with my son, who is just dropping crazy cash on, you know, the Fortnite. and just overall climate, I think those are definitely very interesting trends. So thanks for sharing that. From personal perspective, from focusing a little bit on you as a person, what is one career advice or maybe series of career advice that you had received that you actually do continue to pass forward? Or as you talk to a mentor or, you know, other folks, what are some of the things that really stand out from your early career stages?
Totally. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is, a mentor of mine told me that it will cost you to be distinctive. And that's top of mind because I left Microsoft after 6 months of being there. And everyone who saw me make that decision said, wow, you're crazy. You're never going to get another job. How could you do this? You're so early in your career, et cetera. And I knew there were opportunity costs associated with that, but now I'm doing something that I love and something that I wouldn't trade for anything. And that there was a cost associated with that, right? And if you want to do really great things, you're going to do a lot of things that upset a lot of people, and that's fine. So definitely lean into that. The second thing that kind of sticks with me is like, you kind of have to be content with partial knowledge and be provisionally content with probabilities. And so what does that mean? Like, you're never going to know everything. And so you're constantly learning all the time. And so you should just embrace the ambiguity of it all and kind of walk in with that sort of humble mindset that there's something else for you to learn in every situation. But you should only be provisionally content with possibilities, because a lot of people will try to paint the picture for you or try to tell the story for you, because oftentimes we join stories that are already in progress, but every day is an opportunity to kind of write your own story. And so only be provisionally content with possibilities, because you can create them as well. And the last thing, so I'll just give you three, because I probably could go on forever. I have tons of amazing people that have come across in life who've given me such great advice. Is that art goes places before technology does. And a lot of times people investing in tech, people invest in venture, entrepreneurs, you know, really anyone, they kind of downplay the significance of the insignificant, let's say. When you look at things like NFTs, you look at things like music, you have to understand how these little, seemingly little things affect the daily procession of everyday people, right? Like religion, art, you know, food, these are things that are daily, constant, compounding interactions that people are having, and they influence human behavior. They influence the way that we think about things. And before technology ever gets anywhere to amplify anything, art is there to lay the foundation. And so focusing broadly in your research and your education, making sure to make time for theater, for dance, for music, can only help to kind of bolster and fortify your career and you, just your personal development more generally. So yeah, art goes places before technology does. Be provisionally content with possibilities, content with partial knowledge, and it will cost you to be distinctive, but that doesn't mean that you should spend a little cash.
I love it. Definitely very clear and powerful advice that you've shared there. So definitely much appreciated. In terms of books, share anything that you may be currently reading, or what is one book or a few books that you always recommend to others, and why is that?
Currently reading. I'm currently reading Conditional Citizens, which is a Goodreads recommended book. Not much more I can tell you other than that, because I've just started it this morning. But it is about belonging in America, which seems to be a pretty relevant topic at this point in time. It's consistently been one, just given the history of the United States. Books that I always recommend, I wouldn't say always, but I'll give you three books that have been particularly powerful for me, not in any way related to investing. One is called Braiding Sweetgrass. That book fundamentally shifted the way that I thought about relationships to other people and also to the environment. And so I, every time somebody asks me for a book recommendation, that is now top of mind. Number two, I would say is, I always forget the title of this book, but it's by Ocean Vuong. On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous is the title of the book. It's poetic prose, and I have a deep appreciation for literature that makes you think, but I also have a deep appreciation for literature where you have to stop every sentence and wonder how the author was able to string those words together. And On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous is like just a literary masterpiece, I think, on pushing you to think about your own writing and how lackluster it is in comparison to some of the sentences that this author was able to pull together. I said three, right? So the last one that I'll give you is, maybe I will do one investor book, but Rich Dad Poor Dad is a classic. And my dad made me read that, I don't know, when I was 10. And it has shifted and structured the way that I think about manage my own personal finances, as well as the advice that I give to my younger sister and everyone that I come across who's interested in financial literacy. So outside of the world of nature and the environment, and then also just personal narratives and memoirs, Rich Dad Poor Dad would be my go-to self-help financial empowerment book to recommend to the newcomer.
That's awesome, man. I really appreciate those recommendations, and we'll make those titles available in the show notes. Kai, I can't thank you enough for your time today. It was very short and insightful conversation. Personally learned quite a bit. What I love doing with all the guests is do a follow-up recording in about a year where we revisit the conversation from a year ago and see how much of change transpired, if everything that we've discussed actually still does make sense. So I'm definitely looking forward to doing that with you. So much appreciated.
Totally. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.